Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the real Mohammed. Our guest is Robert Spencer. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are training young men for the pastoral ministry. One of the things they're training them to do is very boldly look at Islam and see it with the clear-eyed view. See it for what it is and see Mohammed for what he was, a false prophet, and preparing them to live in a world where Islam, at least for the foreseeable future, will be a greater and greater influence. Find out more about what Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is doing to train pastors for the 21st century. You can give them a call, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or find their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Folks, if you have questions or comments on Mohammed or Islam, give us a call, 1-800-730-2727, or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Keith from DeSoto, Missouri writes this: does your guest see a time in the future of the U.S. when Islam is stripped of its status as a religion and viewed as an organization on par with, say, the KKK? Keith's question, your answer there, Robert?
Well, if you're talking about in terms of American law, I think that's very unlikely. I do think, however, that steps toward something like that need to be taken in this sense. Islam, from its beginnings, has been political as well as religious in the sense that most people in the Western world understand the term. The year one of the Muslim calendar is not when Muhammad was born or when he died or when he received his first revelation. It is when he became for the first time a political and military leader. That is the beginning of Islam as far as the traditional Islamic theology is concerned. And Islam has always had a political and social element. It has a ready-made system of laws for the governing of states, and pious Muslims believe that those laws are the laws of God that must be implemented as opposed to any what they would consider to be man-made systems. So, including, for that matter, democracy. So I think that it will be ultimately a matter for our national survival for the United States government sometime to recognize the political element of Islam and regard American Muslim groups as political as well as religious and subject them to all the scrutiny and all the standards that political groups are expected to live up to.
Keith, if you would email us with your address, I'm going to send you a copy of The Truth About Mohammed. Thank you very much for your question. So does Islam, at least according to these texts that we're talking about here, does Islam recognize any kind of a separation between mosque and state?
No. Traditional Islam does not recognize any such separation. There is no sacred secular distinction, and it is part of the duty of Muslims to institute the rule of what they see as the law of God.
Is that personified in Muhammad himself in these texts?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The unity of religion and state?
Oh, definitely, because he himself was the head of the state, of the Islamic state, once it was established. And so this was always considered to be part of the nature of Islamic leadership, that he would not only be the religious leader of the community, but the leader of the state.
How did Mohammed, according to the Islamic texts, go from being revelatory prophet, former merchant, to warlord?
What happened was he started out preaching in his hometown of Mecca. The Meccans were pagan Arabs, and they didn't take kindly to his preaching that there was no God but Allah, because they actually ran the shrine that is still there in Mecca, the Kaaba. Now it's a Muslim shrine, of course, but in those days it was a pagan shrine with 360 idols in it, and people would come from all over Arabia to make pilgrimages there, and the Quraysh profited immensely from this. So they didn't much like at all his saying that all the idols that were in the Kaaba were not really gods and didn't deserve to be worshipped, because they figured this was going to be the end of their livelihood. So there was bitterness toward him from the beginning. This was compounded by a certain belligerence on the part of his followers, such that they there was even a murder, a killing, when there was a dispute with the Muslims and the Quraysh. One of the Muslims killed one of the Quraysh rather early on, and things just deteriorated from there. Until finally, there was the final break. It was ultimately in some concern, some fear for his life, that Muhammad left Mecca and went to a nearby city, Medina, where he had been invited by the tribes there to become their leader. And this was the time that I was referring to before, when the Muslims became, for the first time, when Islam became, for the first time, a political and social system. And so, as well as an individual religious faith. And that was when, as Muhammad became, for the first time, a leader, a warlord, a generalissimo, he began to teach that Allah was now allowing for defensive warfare to defend the community, the new community of the Muslims. And after that, because the Muslims are, according to the Quran, in chapter 3, verse 110, it says the Muslims are the best of people. Because they are the best of people, obviously they have a community that ought to be in power, ought to be regarded as having deserving hegemony over the people around the Muslims who are considered renegades. So in ultimately he began to receive revelations enjoining offensive warfare against non-Muslims in order to establish the rule of Islamic law over them. And this was justified, as I say, by the idea that the non-Muslims were renegades because they had rejected Muhammad's prophetic status.
When did the notion of a worldwide hegemony of Islam become popular? Was it during Muhammad's lifetime, or was that after his death?
Well, here again, you know, it depends on how much we trust the early Islamic sources, but the early hadith do have Muhammad talking about the nearby countries and how the Muslims will ultimately conquer them. And it seems to have been certainly part of the understanding of the early Muslims right after his death, when they swept out of Arabia with immense force and just kept going and conquered what is now considered the heart of the Islamic world. They conquered all of the Middle East and into North Africa. They swept into Persia and into what is now Pakistan. They went up into Europe, into Eastern Europe, and into Spain. And there didn't seem to be any limit as far as they were concerned on what they were going to conquer. It seemed clear that they were acting upon Muhammad's command to either convert or subjugate non-Muslims under the rule of Islamic law, and that command was clearly understood as being applicable to all non-Muslims everywhere in the world.
What about Muslim versus Muslim animosity or warfare? Was Islam united completely under Muhammad's rule while he was alive, and only after his death were there different branches that were hostile to one another?
Yeah, he was obviously a highly charismatic figure, and there was no dissent. There was at one point an incident where some people rebelled from him, and he crushed it pretty quickly. But the real big splits come after his death, when you have the Shi'at Ali, it's called, the party of Ali, which has become the Shia, that's the party, you know, and the Sunnis. The Sunna is the tradition, and so the Sunnis are those who follow the tradition. The split comes very early in the life of Islam, right after Muhammad's death. The Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, the Shia, were saying that Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad, should be his successor as the leader of the Muslims, because only a relative of Muhammad should be his successor. The Sunnis, the larger party, said, no, that's not important at all, that it be a relative, it just should be the best man in the community. And so they chose Abu Bakr, who was one of Muhammad's early followers, and he became the first caliph, the first leader of the Muslims. After a while, there were two others, and then Ali did become the caliph, the leader of all the Muslims, but he was killed pretty quickly after that. And then his two sons were also killed, and the split became pretty much permanent and deeply, very, very bitter. You know, you may have seen, Todd, photographs of the Shiite celebration, the Shiite observance every year of mourning for the sons of Ali.
Yeah, they're cutting themselves. And...
yeah, they cut themselves. Their heads are bleeding, and this is to show how deep their grief is for the death of Ali. Shia Islam is very emotional and very tied to these terrible historical incidents, but it has to be borne in mind that what they're mourning is the killing of their leaders by Sunnis. In any case, 85 to 90% of Muslims today are Sunni Muslims, and the rest are Shiites. Most of the rest are Shiites. Shiite Islam is the dominant Islam in Iran, as well as in a majority of Iraq, but they have not been in power there, although they're trying to be now.
Let's talk about Islam today. One of the places where Islam is making some rather remarkable inroads, not only by immigration, but also by procreation, I guess you could say, is in Western Europe. How do you evaluate how Western Europe is reacting to the growing population of Muslims within its borders?
Well, right now, it's still marked mostly by denial and appeasement. Unfortunately, because like when we started the show and we were talking about Islam as a religion of peace, this is still the prevailing view among political leaders in Europe, and it is very bad form to suggest otherwise. And so you have the spectacle of an increasingly restive and assertive Muslim population calling for elements of Sharia law, of Islamic law, in Europe itself, openly boasting in Sweden and elsewhere about how they are going to take over fairly soon. And the European leaders are pursuing a policy of accommodation and appeasement. I hope ultimately they're going to wake up to what they're dealing with, adjust their immigration policies, and recognize that not all the Muslims that are in Europe, and maybe not even a majority, are interested in accepting the rules and mores of Western European society, but instead want to make over that society as Islamic. I hope that they will recognize that before it's too late.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc., coming to you live this Wednesday, the 14th of March. We're giving away Robert Spencer's book called The Truth About Mohammed to listeners with the best questions or comments. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So when we hear leaders like Britain's Tony Blair or leaders in France talk, kind of disparaging the fact that the Muslims in their countries refuse to accommodate, refuse to assimilate into their societies and cultures, is that sufficient concern in your mind?
Well, it's you know, they talk about not wanting to assimilate and that they ought to assimilate, but then they don't do anything to try to get them to assimilate, and they've allowed them to settle in these communities and basically take over these communities all over Europe that are essentially no-go zones. Malmo in Sweden is a notorious example where police, firefighters, ambulances, they don't even venture because they know they'll get stoned if they go in there. It's sort of like Islamic territory. There was a Muslim leader in Britain who recently was berating the Home Secretary who went to speak to Muslims in a Muslim area of East London. And he was berating him and saying, "How dare you come into our territory? You're not welcome here. Our territory? This is Great Britain. There's a part of Great Britain that is not considered to be under the rule of the British government." Well, there are Muslims who believe so. And this is not being confronted so far by European leaders.
As far as you can tell, in your research of over 20 years, how do most Muslims view Mohammed, their prophet and their leader?
Oh, well, most Muslims, even the peaceful Muslims who would never do anything in regard to terrorism, they consider Muhammad to be exactly what I was explaining before, the supreme example of human behavior, an example to be followed for all time. And they may ignore or gloss over or not even be fully informed about the nature of that example in regard to his violence and his teaching of supremacism, but they nonetheless revere him as the greatest of the prophets.
So what can we do when we have lawmakers, policymakers, who at least publicly say things like Islam is peace and continue to perpetuate or allow to be perpetuated a kinder, gentler view of Muhammad and his many followers?
Well, I think we have to continue to try to impress upon them the fact that, you know, while they think that they're being very generous by purveying this kinder, gentler vision of Muhammad, unfortunately, the jihadists are using the much different vision of Muhammad, who's not kind and gentle at all, to make recruits among Muslims. And they're able to do so because these elements of Muhammad's life do exist. And so instead of just pretending that they don't exist while the jihadists use them to recruit, they have to be confronted, and we have to call upon the Muslim leaders who claim to be moderate to confront these aspects of Islam and to reject at least the literal understanding of Muhammad's example in these particulars.
Let's go to the phones and talk with Joe, who's calling from his car. Joe, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. I have a question. If Muhammad were alive today and were able to sit down with President Bush, what would he tell Bush about Islam or what the purpose of Islam is or what they're trying to accomplish?
Great question, Joe. Thank you.
Well, I think that we would have to tell him that there are Muslims who are indeed acting upon the triple choice that I outlined earlier, that Muhammad told his followers to offer to non-Muslims, that they should offer them conversion to Islam or second-class status under the rule of Islamic law or war. And that this is an expansionist, imperialistic agenda that would subjugate women and non-Muslims, and that we need to guard against it accordingly. That doesn't just mean fighting quote-unquote terrorism, but fighting all the ways, including the demographic ways that you mentioned before, Todd. We have to confront all the ways that this agenda of Islamic supremacism is being advanced. And so when Ibrahim Hooper and others say that they'd like to see the United States become Islamic sometime in the future, the United States government, then we have to confront that and say, look, the elected officials of the United States are sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution. We're going to defend this Constitution, and we are going to recognize in doing that the Islamic law is at variance with constitutional principles in various particulars. And so you are not welcome to spread that message here. It's just like communism, you know. Gus Hall and the American Communist Party ran for president every 4 years and worked within the system. But the underground party was outlawed, the party that was working to overthrow the Constitution and the system altogether. And likewise, we have to recognize that there are elements of the American Muslim community that are working to do exactly that also, to replace the Constitution and to work to defend it, to adjust immigration policy, stop bringing in Muslim immigrants without any regard for asking them where they stand vis-a-vis the jihad, and to call American Muslim leaders to account, to acknowledge these aspects of Islam, and to institute comprehensive programs to teach against these teachings of Muhammad, or else they will not be regarded as being on our side.
Would you substitute a different phrase for the term war on terror, and if so, what would it be?
Well, the defense against the global jihad. War on terror. Terror is a tactic. Osama bin Laden didn't invent terrorism. Terrorism, as understood as an attack on innocent civilians in order to demoralize an enemy population, take away its will to fight, that's as old as warfare. And many, many armies have practiced it. And so to wage war on terror is like waging a war on bombs. It's waging war on a means of warfare rather than against a real enemy.
Finally, then, with only a minute, are we in the West guilty of projecting onto Islam our own Western and perhaps Christian notions of tolerance?
Very much so. I think in general, people in the West, even if they're not Christians, they grew up in even in today's society in an atmosphere in which is tremendously still influenced by Christianity, in the sense that when people think about what religion means, what religion is, they inevitably think of Christianity, and so they think that because Islam is a religion, it must necessarily have a benign core, and it must necessarily teach peace and love and harmony, and it doesn't in regard to unbelievers, but you know, people all too often don't want to be confused with the facts.
Finally, with only a few seconds, do you have real hope that the truth about Islam and its prophet might be more popularized, and that it might actually bring about a proper response to, as you call it, global jihad?
Well, I'm going to keep pushing, and there are others like me. The truth will out, I think, ultimately. It'll just become patently obvious that what we've been saying is the truth. I don't have high hopes in terms of some kind of a widespread acceptance of this, such that we can discuss these issues on CBS or ABC or NBC or something like that. Even Fox is pretty shy about talking about them. But the truth will out. Every time they win, they lose. Every time that they intimidate the American people, intimidate American businesses or publications, every time that they commit a terrorist attack, more people wake up.
1-800-737-0172 is the phone number for our resource line. You can use that number to request a free complimentary copy of our Next Issues, Etc. journal, or you can also use that number to make a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. You can also donate by check, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117 is our address. No gift is too small. The address again, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Robert Spencer has studied Islamic theology, law, and history for more than 20 years. He's director of Jihad Watch, their website address, jihadwatch.com, jihadwatch.com. And he's author of several books, including his latest called The Truth About Muhammad, Founder of the World's Most Intolerant Religion. Robert, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you.
I want you to compare two figures, if you would. It struck me in the course of our conversation with Robert that could we ever even imagine, people often compare Jesus and Muhammad, could we ever even imagine the saga of Jesus as warlord or as military leader or as political leader or as someone scheming and plotting in order to see that his enemies gain no foothold, ordering the assassination of those who mock him? Contrast the two, if you would. Muhammad, as he is presented in the holy writings of Islam, that's the one picture. And Jesus, as he is presented in the holy writings of Christianity, a man who bore the mocking without retaliation, who did not seek revenge upon his enemies, who had no aspirations toward political or military conquest, but came as God in human flesh, bearing our sins in total service of those who were his sworn enemies, who had nothing but hostility toward him. You, me, and he gave his life for them at the cross. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you thinking about a gift for your kids or your grandkids for the Easter season? Well, think about our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March called Easter Is For Me. It's a children's book set in rhyme and verse. It tells the story of Jesus' death and resurrection for sinners. It's the Easter story. You can find Easter Is For Me at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The other is at 3558 South Jefferson in the city. When you visit, ask for Easter Is For Me, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. Those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, called Easter Is For Me. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org.
From the Jews to being like the Greeks. Answers with Ken Ham, a worldwide speaker and author on the topic of creation and evolution. Well, Ken, something of an interesting riddle today that you posed. What has changed from being like the Jews to now being like the Greeks?
Well, the answer is our society. Let me explain, Mark. When the Apostle Peter preached the message of the cross on the day of Pentecost, as recorded in the book of Acts, thousands were converted. Now think about who he was preaching to. Most of these people understood that God was creator. They knew what was meant by sin. After all, they had the law of Moses. They knew what was right and wrong. But when Paul preached to the Greeks, as recorded in Acts 17, they rejected his message. Now, these people had no concept of a creator God or the meaning of sin. That's why Paul had to start at the beginning, in Genesis, to explain these things before people could understand the gospel. Well, I believe our Western societies used to be like the Jews. Christian teaching once permeated people's thinking. Sadly, though, through years of evolutionary indoctrination, well, our society is now like the Greeks. We have to understand this change if we want to effectively communicate the gospel. People need the answers from the book of Genesis so they'll understand today that Christ is the answer.
Many of today's Western nations are involved in what could be called a culture war. Ken Ham shares his insights in a free booklet, available for your reading at AnswersRadio.com.
Here's a familiar text. Behold, I am the one who has laid as a foundation in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. It's found in Isaiah chapter 28. We'll deal with chapters 28 through 33 next time on our 10:05 Bible study with Pastor David Boyce Clare. Listen to the Bible study weekday mornings.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Christ Academy is a two-week residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here's the director of Christ Academy, Brian Gurman.
The students at Christ Academy live in the dorms as a seminarian would. They study under the seminary professors, and they worship in Kramer Chapel. And it is literally taking the seminary experience and getting a good taste of it for those 2 weeks. And what they learn in the classroom, then they experience in Kramer Chapel, as that is really the center of the experience, just as it is throughout the academic year here on campus as well.
At Christ Academy, high school-aged men explore the possibility of someday becoming a pastor. Christ Academy takes place June the 17th through the 30th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. Look for the Christ Academy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155. Welcome back for the last half hour of Issues Etc. If you were walking by the newsstand, you might have seen Newsweek, the cover story, The Evolution Revolution, the New Science of Brain and DNA, is rewriting the story of human origins. Very interesting story. If you looked in there, they have, you know, the old picture you used to see in the textbooks of the little tiny primate, and then he's followed by a slightly larger primate, and then a larger one, and as the progression goes on, they walk more and more erect until finally you got a full-blown naked human being all walking in the same direction. And it was always talked about the origins of man. Well, they've got a new model for that. You find it in the Newsweek story. We're going to be talking about it for the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. Dr. Duane Gish is our guest. He has a degree in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. He's Senior Vice President of the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California, and he's author of the book Evolution, The Fossils Still Say No. Dr. Gish, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Why is it, Dr. Gish, every time I turn around, there's another headline or magazine story modifying, changing, evolving the theory of evolution?
Well, I think what evolutionists have decided to do, to get together and to get as many articles, as many claims as they can, write an article about it and submit it to the leading newspapers throughout the United States and to the videos and so forth to play up this material in their efforts to silence the creationist or to put us off in the wings somewhere. I really think that is what is going on here. So much of this stuff comes out, and it's promoted as something very exciting and so forth and so on. It really is not that. Now, what this article that I've been reading, it's published in Newsweek, it's based on the fact that they have a curator there at the American Museum in New York City. They got a new hall, and they put everything they can put together on human origins in there, and they're promoting this and making a big deal of it, and this is designed to convince people of the truth of evolution. That's really what it's all about. And the article itself actually deals with the fact that there's a lot of contentious ideas among evolutionists about how evolution took place, or that is, human evolution. And it's a very interesting article, and it has some interesting material, but it's really emphasizing some of the differences among evolutionists today.
It's kind of odd. I was reading through this from the lay perspective, and one might get the impression that the evolutionists, or at least there's a branch of the evolutionists, when it comes to human origins, who are kind of giving up on the fossil record and pursuing other lines of inquiry. Are they giving up on the fossil record?
Yes. I'll tell you what they do. And this article is using this very heavily, the so-called molecular clock. They're going to use the DNA, try to trace through DNA and so forth and so on, to give the answers to these big questions. Now, this idea of a molecular clock is the idea that mutations occur at a steady rate. It's just like the clock on the wall. It's a steady process. And therefore, if you determine how many mutations have occurred, you can go back and calculate how long ago that happened, because you have determined the rate at which the clock is moving. And they call that the molecular clock. I'm really surprised to see this promoted so strongly, because in all of my reading in the scientific literature, there's so much of this that there's so many of these evolutionists have said, no, there's no such thing as a molecular clock. It doesn't run at the same rate. And you get one story using fossils, and then you use this molecular clock idea, you get a very different story. And as a matter of fact, if in constructing this molecular clock, we'll say you use a certain DNA molecule or a certain protein to determine the rate, now if you use a different molecule of some kind, you get a different rate. And I've read so much in the literature where scientists, the evolutionists, these guys are evolutionists, who say that the molecular clock doesn't work, we shouldn't use it, there's no such thing as a molecular clock. And yet in this article published in Newsweek, it's all about the molecular clock and how they determine these rates and so forth and so on. It's amazing to me that we find that much in there when there's so much contention and so much total disagreement about how this so-called molecular clock works or doesn't work.
So there may well be evolutionists in the know reading this Newsweek article hopping mad because this, what they consider to be a bogus notion of a molecular clock, is being pushed as the new way of determining human origins.
Yes, yes, certainly. You know, there was an article several years ago about the so-called mitochondrial Eve. That is, now, the mitochondria are the little energy factories that we have in every one of our cells. We get those only from our mother. We do not get them from our father. And so these people went through women all over the world and tested their mitochondrial DNA and determined the differences and so forth and so on. And they came up with the conclusion that the mitochondrial Eve had come out of Africa, and she was the ancestor of all of us. All of us can trace our ancestry back to this one woman, this mitochondrial Eve. And using some of the assumptions that they use, they came up with the conclusion that it was 200,000 years ago when she came out of Africa. Well, since that time, rather than assuming a certain mutation rate, they actually determined the rate of mutations at which they occur. Now, using this new data, the mitochondrial Eve was dated at 6,000 years. Now, this article appeared in Nature magazine, and here we got her down to the biblical, around the biblical age, and they said, of course, we know that's not true. But they said, now that's the actual age that they determined, 6,000 years. They said, well, that's a forensic age, but we'll just use the evolution age at 200,000 years. It's an amazing thing.
So even using their own, even using their rate of change clock that they wanted to use, they've essentially had to say, well, okay, we like the idea that we can measure human origins by a molecular clock, but since the clock doesn't run at the pace we expect it to, we're just going to assume that it's running at a different pace.
Yes. When it came up against what they believed, then they wouldn't believe it. They said, well, we just won't use this. You see, that's the forensic age. In other words, that's the one we actually determined, but the evolutionary age is 200,000 years. And they just went against their own data.
What was the old model of human origins? I think it's popularly pictured by the progression of from small primate to full-sized man. And what's the so-called new model of human origins being put?
Well, the old model was a straight line. You go from, back to the early apes, and then there's a split, and it gives rise to this form, and then this one gives rise to that form. It's a straight line thing. Now they say we know that that's not true. It's more like a bush. It's not a straight line, but a profusion of branches. And here, what they say is they more than once in human prehistory, evolution created a modern trait, such as a face, without jutting ape-like brains and jaws, only to let it go extinct before trying again a few million years later. And they go on to say, our species travels through time, proceeded in fits and starts, with long period of nothing much happened, punctuated by burst of dizzying change. That was a quote from Ian Tattersall of the American Museum.
But I'm looking at this new model as a bush, and I'm thinking to myself, that almost assumes that there is some sort of a grand plan here, that evolution somehow evolution personified realizes it got it wrong and says, okay, I'll wait a little longer and try it again, when in fact, if the model is true, the dead ends, the so-called dead ends in the model, are sometimes far removed from the actual traceable line of human origins here.
Well, that's exactly what some of this data, what they're pointing out. Some of this data is determining. And it's, of course, it's very contentious, and I was really, really interested to learn what they say about Homo erectus. Homo erectus is supposed to be our direct ancestor, but they say they have found one over in Chad, and Homo erectus, he looks very human-like, but it had its brain size was only around 600,000 or 600 and compared to the modern humans, about 1,400 cc's, this is about 600. And what they are saying here, and it's hard for me to really believe they're saying this, because evolutionists have always said that Homo erectus is our ancestor, but in this article, they say that Homo erectus was not our ancestor, although he looked very much like us, and he was not our ancestor. Well, that is really a problem for evolutionists then, but that's what they say in this article. And you know, the Peking man creature discovered many years ago was supposed to be a Homo erectus and supposed to be our ancestor. But actually, as turned out, you see, they say that Peking man there in China was found in a cave, and there was evidence that he used fire and so forth and so on. But scientists in more recent time went over there and studied that area very carefully, and they declared that the ashes were not from a hearth or anything like that. It had nothing to do with people cooking or anything like that. And there was not a cave there. It was a shaft, a deep shaft. And it points out that these things were really not human at all, not related to anything human.
We're talking about the Newsweek magazine cover story called The Evolution Revolution and the Origins of Man is the subject. Dr. Duane Gish is our guest. He has his doctorate in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley, senior vice president of the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California, and author of the book Evolution, The Fossils Still Say No. You can join us. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Coming to you live this Wednesday, the 14th of March. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin, and you're listening to Issues Etc. What do the fossils really show? Do believers, as myself, in a literal six-day creation, according to the biblical record, do we have anything to fear from the fossil record?
Actually, it is our greatest ally. Let me describe some of the evidence from the fossil record that shows that evolution definitely has not taken place on this planet. In rocks called Cambrian rocks, they're scattered all over the world. In these rocks, according to evolutionists, the Cambrian rocks began to be formed about 530 million years ago. And now they say maybe it took about 5 million years for these rocks to form. In these rocks, all over the world, we find fossils of complex invertebrates, clams and snails and trilobites, and many other very complex invertebrates. Billions times billions of fossils of these things are found scattered all over the world in these Cambrian rocks. Now, underneath these rocks are what are called Precambrian rocks. Evolutionists believe that Precambrian rocks were laid down prior to and leading up to the Cambrian. Now, if that is true, and these animals in the Cambrian evolved from some other form, beginning with a microscopic form of life, which gave rise to higher and higher forms, and finally gave rise to clams and snails and jellyfish and brachiopods and things like that. In these Precambrian rocks, we must find the ancestors of clams and snails and jellyfish and brachiopods and trilobites and things like that. Quite obviously, it must be billions times billions of those things showing the conversion of a little single-cell creature all the way up to these complex invertebrates. However, nowhere on the face of this earth has anyone found fossilized ancestors to these Cambrian creatures. They all appear fully formed, and there are no transitional forms suggesting that they evolved from a common ancestor. Now, evolutionists have been looking for their ancestors for 200 years. They've never found any ancestors for these creatures, Every one of those creatures appear fully formed without a trace of an ancestor and nothing indicating that they evolved from a common ancestor. Now, furthermore, evolutionists believe that one of these invertebrates, a clam or a snail or something like that, evolved into a fish, which would be the first vertebrate. And it would take millions and millions of years for these things to evolve into fish. Now, we find, as I said, billions times billions times billions of fossils of these invertebrates. We find billions times billions of fossils of different kind of fishes. Tremendous numbers of these fossils have been found. Now, if evolution is true and some invertebrate evolved into a fish, there would be billions times billions of fossils of the transitional form, showing all the intermediate stage as something, maybe a worm or something, an invertebrate of some time, of some kind, gradually evolved into a fish with a vertebrate. We ought to have billions times billions times billions of these fossils. As a matter of fact, every major kind of fish appears in the fossil record complete without a trace of an ancestor. There are no links linking them to common ancestors. There's not a single transitional form from one of these invertebrates to a fish. Now, that cannot be true, and evolution be true. If evolution is true, our museum should have truckloads of the transitional forms between an invertebrate and a fish, and they don't have any. As far as I'm concerned, that settles the question.
Let's go to the phones in the last few minutes here and talk first with Miles, who's calling from his car. Hi, Miles.
Hi. I was a little off topic, but I wonder if Dr. Gish would care to comment on possible alternate theories for the source of so-called fossil fuels. I think the guy's name was Thomas Gold, who proposed a theory of gases coming out from the Earth's crust and being converted by essentially bacteria.
All right, Miles, it's a good question. We're told, or at least I was told when I was in grade school, that the fossil fuels came from the decomposing plant and animal matter piled up over millions of years. Your thoughts?
Yes, as he mentioned, Gold said that there are large, huge reservoirs of methane deep into the earth, and that this was the source of much of this material. Now, we know coal is derived from a plant. We know that. But the oil, we don't know that. And it is possible that a large amount of this fossil fuel, especially the oil, could be from something besides plant material or marine organisms or something like that. That has been suggested. That is possible, and it would be very interesting if that were true. There'd be perhaps some huge sources of gases that would be available then.
We
can't say, but at least there is that possibility.
Here's Mark. He's on the line calling from his car as well. Hi, Mark.
Gentlemen, good evening. I was wondering if they can trace this through this mitochondrial cell back to a woman named Eve. Shouldn't they be able to trace it back to an ape or a monkey or something? If evolution is true, that is.
Thank you very much, Mark. Dr. Gish?
Yes, and this is what they're trying to do. They assert that, of course, there are intermediates between apes and humans. And from time to time, they claim they have found some evidence for this. And of course, many of these claims to fall by the wayside. Piltdown man turned out to be a complete fraud. Nebraska man turned out to be a pig's tooth. And some of these other things turned out with no relationship at all between ape and man. And actually, it is said, this article said there's only 1.2% difference in the DNA of a chimpanzee and a human. Let me tell you what we are finding now, that we have the human genome and the chimpanzee genome, you can actually compare the human to the chimpanzee, and they're finding there's a tremendous difference in between chimpanzees and humans. Now, there are a lot of similarities. Of course, we would expect our DNA to be similar to chimpanzee in many ways. If a chimp is eating a banana and a human is eating banana, obviously they both have the same digestive system, so they have the same digestive enzymes and so forth and so on. Of course, so much of our DNA is similar to that of chimpanzee, but there are tremendous differences between the chimpanzee and a human. And, of course, they have the faith that this did actually occur. But as this article brought out, even among evolutionists now, it's very contentious how human evolution occurred. And they are running into a lot of problems, and I'm convinced the more we learn about the human genome versus these others, it will show that difference had to be the result of an intelligent agent.
Dr. Duane Gish is our guest. He is a senior vice president of the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California. You can visit their website tonight when you get home. It's icr.org, icr.org. Dr. Gish has his doctorate in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley, and he's author of the book Evolution, The Fossils Still Say No. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Certainly is my pleasure.
Tomorrow on the program, we're going to begin a three-part series with our good friend and regular guest, Dr. Stephen Hine, on what we're calling the false views of spiritual ascent. Think about it as ladders that man constructs to try and reach God or reach heaven. There are three. We're going to be doing a series on them. Tomorrow, we'll begin with the one that probably is most familiar to all of us. It's moralism. Also tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about St. Patrick with Pastor Greg Alms. Carol Hansen will join us to talk about the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we'll continue our series every Thursday with Deaconess Pam Nielsen on teaching a Sunday school lesson. Tomorrow's lesson is going to be Luke 15, Jesus Finds the Lost. We'll also play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week tomorrow on Issues Etc. Well, you read these headlines, and every time they find a tooth or a bit of a skull or a bit of a finger bone or something along those lines, almost every time it makes headlines. There is someone, somewhere, claiming that they've found the missing link or the intermediate form or the key to understanding the origins of human evolution. But just wait. That'll change soon. Sooner or later, they'll find out that it wasn't. And the theory of evolution will continue to evolve to fit the facts or the lack thereof. You can be sure of that. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.